I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. To encounter Alexandra Kleeman's newest novel, Something New Under the Sun, is to fundamentally change your expectations for what a climate novel should be. In Alexandra's imagining, the work of climate fiction is no longer simply apocalyptic visions of a broken planet. Rather, Something New Under the Sun preserves the pleasures of the novel. Its domestic focus on everyday lives, its curiosity about how community and society reveal themselves even in a single intimate relationship, a propulsive plot with real stakes, and the formal pastiche that has come to distinguish contemporary fiction. This new kind of climate fiction balances the demand for an awakening to the present dystopia ravaging much of the planet with art's ability to reframe what defines a meaningful life. Her story is set in a California much like ours, riven by droughts and fires, but this California has run out of water, leaving corporate interests to fill the gap, or the tap, that is. Within this ecological context, Alexandra draws out the story of a lost novelist and a former child actor, a sea in their personal lives, but increasingly convinced that there is a mysterious plot afoot to hide the consequences of a world without water. In our interview, Alexandra and I discuss privacy in the age of omnipresent self-surveillance. We talk about art's way forward in grappling with climate decline, the fun and practice of writing funny, the Flint water crisis, the horrors and delights of living in Staten Island, and so much more. You are in for a real treat. Let's start the show. Welcome back. What a pleasure it is to welcome Alexandra Kleeman to the show. Alexandra is the author of Intimations, short stories that Robert Coover called brilliantly crafted nightmares about the dissolving of reality. Her first novel, You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine, was awarded the 2016 Bard Fiction Prize and was a New York Times Editor's Choice. In 2020, she was awarded both the Rome Prize and the Berlin Prize. She is currently assistant professor in the MFA program at the New School. Alexandra's latest novel, and the subject of our conversation today, is Something New Under the Sun, which you've likely already seen atop the must-read lists of pretty much every publication worth reading. It's just as likely that you've seen the stunning cover, a man engulfed with a graphic overlay of dazzling flames, in the staff recommendation shelves of your local bookstore. It is that kind of novel. Something New Under the Sun is set in a place and time like ours, in a California racked by fires and droughts, and where the West Coast water supply has all but run dry, leaving an opening for corporations to develop a synthetic water, which appears in everything from restaurants to the public water supply. Enter Patrick Hamlin, East Coast novelist of middling fame, who has come to California to observe the transformation of his novel into a feature film. What he believes is a consultancy position turns out to be a PA job, ferrying around the temperamental star of his film, the former child actor Cassidy Carter. Patrick and Cassidy's strange and strained acquaintanceship will lead them to uncover a vast conspiracy, both of Hollywood and corporate water interests. Meanwhile, Patrick's wife and daughter have escaped to a commune where the lost species of the earth are constantly mourned. Alexandra brings us into this mostly familiar world both as a clarion call to our wounded planet and as a provocative and witty examination of how our relationships, intimate and otherwise, rely on the same kind of care and vulnerability that the environment desperately needs from us. Her voice is electric, equally compelling in punchy dialogue and vivid portraits of a landscape on fire. She manages to snap jokes while convincing us that we are long overdue in beginning the process of mourning what has been lost from the earth. Alexandra has given us a new kind of climate change art, and we're lucky for it. Welcome to the show, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, we're very excited to have you. And I wanted to start out with a question that is sparked by something that Rahman Alam said on this show. He said that all fiction is climate fiction now, whether the author intends it to be or not. Yours is a purposeful climate disaster novel, the fires of California, droughts, the coming water shortages. But do you agree with Rahman? And is the transition of our art into climate art one of the fundamental changes that needs to happen in order to address our planetary crisis?
Yeah, you know, I love Rahman's book, and I especially love the way that it showed that the pressures of climate change are narrative pressures. They are going to force us into different relationships with those around us. And for that reason, I think that it calls for literature to take on a different form and to reflect the ways in which these pressures will play out, which is alternately large-scale changes to everyday life, but an increasing mundanity to the crisis, to the catastrophe that forces us suddenly into an emergency and adaptive situation. One thing I do wonder about, though, is whether it really is becoming the norm that climate change is depicted in our literature, because I think that there's still a way in which the conventions of domestic realism are kind of at odds with the task of depicting these sorts of unusual but increasingly regularized events, sort of in the way that Amitav Ghosh points out in his book, The Great Derangement, that our idea of how people's lives unfold against a fairly steady background doesn't admit the sort of shifting and increasingly precarious eruption of background into foreground that we're seeing recently. So I think there is still some change to come in terms of our literature becoming one of climate change, but I do think it would be the direction we should move in.
Yeah, I agree. And your point about Ghosh's book makes me think of Tim Winson, who's a literary critic who writes very thoughtfully about climate change as a scalar problem. It's too vast and too planetary for the average person to comprehend in their daily lives. They often can't see the coming disaster because it's too totalizing. And therefore, it's difficult to convince the general public to make, as you say, the profound changes to their lives that needs to happen. Because the novel is a largely domestic genre, and it's concerned with the lives of a few people and in great minutiae, but it can also, I think, do thinking on a larger societal scale. If we're going to move, as you say, more literature in that direction, do you think the novel is a form that can do it? Can it balance those two things?
I think so. I think that the novel is our tool for understanding and mapping and representing what our lives look like. I think that on a personal basis, we have very little ability to picture ourselves within the whole. And these apprehensions of wholeness or of connectivity come in flashes as we sort of are popped out of our insular and individually oriented gazes. So because the novel is made to travel between gazes, made to link things that aren't on their surface linked perhaps, and made to sort of represent the world in whatever version of the world that we believe that we're living through, I think that it can do that. I think that we have to figure out on a project-by-project basis where we can break the rules and what that will do to expanding our understanding of the world that's being represented and the type of reality that's being represented.
I actually think you do a wonderful job dramatizing this with the sort of parallel story of Allison, Patrick's wife, and his daughter Nora at the commune Earth Bridge, where residents practice communal mourning for the lost species of the planet. But she puts a finer point on it when she asks the director how he decides every day how many animals he's going to publicly mourn with the residents. She says, how do you make sense of it all? The information in the data. And I love that. How do you decide when it's time for a loss to be mourned? And when do you need to wait to declare it because there's still something bigger to lose? And he responds in such a great comic line that he tries to keep it at three max per day. But in the kind of like his throwaway and her utterly serious question, it made me think that the problem is understanding the link between the information and the data, and then the data and the mourning. And I wonder whether you were trying to think that through with her story.
Absolutely. I mean, the information infrastructure that we have in place now is, you know, one of these tools that will be key to us wrapping our minds around a crisis that is planetary and global and happening at an utterly different scale from the individual or neighborhood or family or all of these modes that we're most comfortable with using and that come most instinctively to us. But at the same time, that information infrastructure, it has an inhuman quality. It has an overwhelming quality. And I think that in this book, you keep coming up against characters who are having trouble sizing their situation to their comprehension. Like, it's as though our mind is a cookie cutter trying to make something out of the world that we can consume comfortably, you know, a mouth-sized cookie instead of a world-sized cookie. I think that, you know, the Earth Bridge solution of keeping it to three, on the one hand, that's an offhand comment, that's a joke. But on the other hand, I think there is a real question about what is the level of information that we need to make a problem feel real and concrete? What's the level of information we need to make it feel like something we can act upon instead of something that overwhelms us and crushes us completely? And in that sense, the three per day and the regularity of it and the daily presence of it does seem like a shift in how we suture our mundane experience or everyday experience to this larger and world-sized problem. Now, whether it causes people at Earthbridge to act in a way that changes the world, I'm not totally sure, but it does seem like a truer or more accurate way to live in this time.
Yeah, and that's the question, isn't it? Because on one hand, we think that here's this pure experience of it. And as you say, there's like a digestible amount of it. You mourn it together. You have a purpose. And yet it seems as, I don't want to use this word lightly, but as kind of feckless as the other side of it, Patrick just sort of like bumbling through California, hoping to achieve some next step of fame and maybe befriend, you know, a star or two. And both of those kind of seem ill-equipped to deal with it.
Yes, yes. I think that, you know, this question of what lies between this habitual and uncorrectable attachment to our old goals and to sort of giving up those goals and not really having something specific to put in its place, new goals. That's the problematic that the book churns through. And in my mind, the person who has the most handle on what these new rules might be is Nora, who is the child and who doesn't give us a fully developed like ethical program to follow instead, but who knows that both set solutions are dissatisfying. I think that the key is, for example, in reorienting our valuation of progress, like from the economic, from public success in the public sphere, to the communal, the personal, and to something like, for example, not a GDP measure, but a measure of happiness, a measure of care or longevity or these other things that really reflect whether we're thriving or not, whether we are well.
Yeah, and it's so a sort of funny anecdote, somewhat embarrassing to me, but I went into mm-hmm. class one day and had read this story that Gen Z was mad at like Gen X's jeans or something, that they were not like a good fashion, and I said, are you all on board with this? And they said, why are you asking us about this? We're having to deal with the climate catastrophe that you left for us, and this article makes it seem like we're in a fight about jean fashion. And I thought, okay, like clearly the younger generation is like Nora. They understand fecklessness when they see it, and they want something different, and they're gonna, you know, depend on new ways of measuring that are not GDP linked.
Yeah, so I think that oftentimes we're most comfortable talking about generational conflict in these very shallow terms, like it's fashion, it's what one generation is wearing that another generation hates, or it's this friction between surface level details, how someone talks, the slang they use, and things like that. But really, there's a much deeper rift there that all of this sort of surface level generational discourse covers up, which is that a lot of the basic assumptions about what success means or what growth and progress means at a personal and societal level do not hold for this new generation. And that gives me hope, because I think that these are ideas that, you know, we've worked to denaturalize in our analysis and our reading and scholarship and in our own lives, that the coming generation just doesn't hold. They see right through it. And if something good is coming, I think it comes largely as a result of this coming generation, what they're going to do to the world.
It's interesting that you talk about the rhetoric of progress, because a colleague of mine in environmental science has just written a big article for the Journal of American Environmental Studies, and it is about what he calls basically the short history of the narrative of progress, and that this that one of the major things that needs to happen is a kind of undoing, as you say, denaturalizing of that narrative of progress, and that it is not a long portion of humanity's lifetime, and certainly not in Earth time. But but in any case, one of the things that you really highlight in a way that is frightening in its prophecy is the coming water shortages. And I don't know if you're familiar with the movie The Big Short, but it dramatizes the crash of the subprime housing market and the subsequent Great Recession. And there's a quote at the end of the movie that tells us about the life of one of the real life investors in the movie. Quote, Michael Burry is focusing all his trading on one commodity, water. I remember thinking that this detail was fanciful at the time, designed to provoke, but now it seems prophetic. When you were writing this, did you draw from news about the future of water, and are you worried about that your novel will become prophetic?
Yeah, absolutely. I drew from news. Like, one thing that was going on while I was writing was the Flint water crisis. And to me, this crisis, which was provoked by the substitution of a local cheaper source of water in the city of Flint, Michigan, for the one that they'd been using before, which came from Detroit, the new water that they were using had a different composition, different pH balance, and interacted differently with the old lead pipes that they have throughout the city's infrastructure, and started to leach lead out and into the water supply. It was years of residents noticing our water is not clear, our water has a taste, we're experiencing health problems, you know, related to lead poisoning, before anyone paid attention to that situation. And I think that it points, for one thing, to this logic of substitution that we're so comfortable with as consumers. Like, if our preferred brand isn't there, let's use the other brand. Like, these things are all equivalent and we can have preferences about them, but we place a lot of trust in our infrastructure and in the mode of delivery that our government and locality chooses. So I, on the one hand, wanted to talk about the water supply in this way, the specificity of it, the inexact replication of, mm-hmm. of things that we desperately need. But, you know, as I wrote, and even now, new news comes up all the time. Like last I heard, the Koch brothers are now investing in water desalination and Lord. Water speculation. Very bad sign when the Koch brothers do anything.
Yeah.
And then there's news too recently, like in California, that Mendocino County, for example, has been bussing water in from a neighboring area because their water supply, their local water supply has been insufficient for their needs due to the drought. And just now, I think this neighboring locality has ceased bussing water over because they're having their own shortages. So, you know, our systems are more fragile than we imagine. And the particular distribution of water that we've believed is sort of omnipresent and, you know, always available is not really as omnipresent and available as we think. I think that growing up in Colorado, where you could say that we're often in a drought, but you might also want to reframe that and say, like, water scarcity is just a fact of life in the West, you know, and mm-hmm. it's something that you become very conscious of when you see, you know, periods of ample water juxtaposed with periods of water scarcity and how it affects everything around you, every bit of land, every vegetation. It's a sort of attentiveness to water that that landscape evokes that I think would be useful spread across the country as a whole. Because in New York, where I am, it's much easier to ignore it, but there is still this whole web work of infrastructure and resource delivery that enables us to have such great tap water here. And it's all connected to these reservoirs and in the Catskills and Hudson Valley that they protect very well. To be conscious of where water comes from and conscious of the meaning and effort underlying that, I think, is both part of appreciating what we have and being cognizant of the ways in which that could change, where we need to build resilience.
Mm, and that's so nicely said. And one of the things your novel did for me was to make me more kind of want to be more conscious about where water comes from. It's so taken for granted where I live. It's considered to be in great abundance with stores of it. But I was just visiting Colorado this summer, and it was very interesting to talk about people who were thinking of the seasons not just as this is hot and cold, but this is no water and maybe water season.
Yes.
And that just, it shook me, I have to say. And I feel like that's Patrick Hamlin in your book. He comes from the East mm-hmm. Coast. He literally has no idea that the situation is so bad in California and everyone is drinking this water substitute. And he's like, why are you drinking this? And everyone in California has already moved so far beyond water as we know it that they can only remember the mango flavor of the particular one that they drink the most of. And I just thought that was a really powerful thing to kind of shock the reader with.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one thing that really amazes me is how large this country is, driving across it and spending time sort of in pandemic times when it wasn't as easy to travel around. It's this experience both of crossing very different landscapes over, you know, hours and hours of driving, but also when immersed in one landscape, of having the physical and sensory presence of that landscape fill your whole field of vision and field of knowledge in such a way that it's hard to imagine things being physically and climatically different someplace mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. I think when I'm, for example, on the East Coast and I'm reading about the wildfires in the West, it's very difficult to wrap your mind around the scale, the square footage of the amount of land that's being burned. The size of New Jersey, I think, was burning in Montana recently.
Oh, wow.
And it's a mental effort, I think, to try to lasso those different things into one coherent representation or understanding of the country.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, why we're going to have to rely on art and different kinds of media to be able to bring those kinds of perspectives into focus. Because they are, you walk out of your, wherever you live, and you look at the environment around you, and that is the environment for you. And then to understand that different parts of the planet are reacting very differently to the current crisis is, as you say, it takes effort. It takes work, but it may also take other forms of experience, either through art or other means. And I worry we're maybe not acclimating quick enough to welcoming those kinds of perspectives. And instead, we look at Instagram, which is just this sort of strange mirror.
Absolutely.
So the California of your novel, water has become a commodity for the very rich, with the majority of the population left to drink a water substitute, water, with the E replaced by a hyphen. This synthetic water is omnipresent, even coming out of the taps in some homes. This, too, is a commodity that is sold at many price points, with the least artificial version selling for hundreds of dollars an ounce. This is a perfect capitalist scam. Control the real water and make it luxury while producing the replacement that is more expensive the closer it is to the real thing. How did you come up with this capitalist mousetrap? And is it something you see functioning in regular everyday life?
I think a lot of what art was inspired by watching the bottled water industry, which is an industry sort of rife with contradictions. Water is best the closer it is to some idea of purity, to some idea of sameness to what we've experienced before. And at the same time, to sell it better than the other brands, it has to be special. So how is something exemplary of a basic need and also special and distinguished from other competitors? A lot of the branding that you see in the bottled water industry, I think, is replicated in water. And since this book came out, people send me advertisements all the time of strange new forms of water that they see advertised near them, like alkaline waters, new vitamin waters, oxygenated water. And it speaks, I think, to this reflexive operation of the capitalist branding machine that segments up product space and designates like who it's for so they can push it more effectively. But as in Flint, I think the people who always get the short end of the stick are people who have less choice, people who have less buying power. And as in like most cases of environmental injustice, the most dangerous substances are pushed toward them. So when we wander outside of the car with the main characters in my book and we go into the surrounding neighborhoods, it's tankers of water refilled by the water truck once a week, which is unreliable, which can spring a leak, and which is of a quality that Patrick might not touch. And Brenda and Jay, the sort of villainous producers, would definitely never get anywhere near.
I had an eerie experience of teaching. I taught at a summer program for high school students, and there happened to be a young woman whose family was deeply affected by the Flint water crisis. And she said very frankly, I'm the only one who's not testing as having a mental consequence because of this. And my other siblings are all, they have been, their emotional and mental growth has been stunted by this and probably permanently. And I had at that point heard of it and was outraged in a kind of banal, like, that's terrible way. But, you know, listening to the extent to which that family had to go to borrow money to buy bottled water, because you'd have to have so much of it to be able to cook with, wash yourself with, drink. And then, you know, to find her being the last really hope of the family to go on and get a college degree. And at that point, it turned into real outrage and amazement that it could happen anywhere. I always think it's bizarre that people say things like, how could this happen in America? Well, how could it happen to any group of human beings on the planet? But in any case, that I feel like what you're doing with Watch Her there feels so scarily present to me. And it's, even though there are a lot of marvelous kind of inside jokes in the industry, I think you do a good job of keeping the weightiness of it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, just as our idea of the default reality that operates in a, you know, literary novel, I think needs to change. I think our default understanding of what America is needs to change too, and incorporate deeply like these structural injustices and harms, right, that are built into the nature of this country. And I feel like that's the work that's being done in the foreground more and more. But when we register surprise at an injustice made public or of a harm done, especially to the most vulnerable populations, that surprise comes out of a place deeply held within myself too, that hasn't truly incorporated that lesson, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. In a kind of very dramatic change of tone, I want to talk a little bit about how funny this book is. I think you're an incredibly funny writer. Your other works have been noted for your sharp wit. And I don't offer this praise lightly, because I think it's really one of the hardest things to do as a fiction writer, maybe second only to good sex writing. There's a moment in the novel when you are describing what is essentially an IKEA for this synthetic water. Would you be willing to read a bit of this section for us?
Yes, okay, thank you. As they walk from the rotunda to the innards of the store, Patrick asks Horseshoe if there's any way to get to their destination faster. Shouldn't there be a path straight to the dedicated bulk ordering station for people on tight schedules, VIPs, elderly customers who lack stamina? But Horseshoe assures him that the store is deeply democratic in design. Every person, no matter how rich or poor, walks the same long path. There's wisdom in the path, which leads past countless fake rooms, even whole fake houses, each one decorated with care. There's an upscale metrosexual loft kitchen, stocked with premium water in the now familiar diamond-faceted bottles, a cozy Scandinavian kitchen with bottles of water cookie burst on display next to a carved wooden bird. A petite woman with a ponytail urges shoppers to go with the flow and dream yourself into your own water lifestyle fantasy. To Patrick, the naked commercialism on display here, the marketing muscle that's gone into making a basic drinking liquid aspirational, is repulsive. But when he sees the girls stripping off t-shirts to reveal genuine bikini tops, taking selfies in front of a replica Caribbean beach with bottles of tropical-infused water, coconut vacation, hoisted toward the camera lens, he can't help but wish he were young again and able to join in the pageant without self-awareness, without guilt. Why is there a whole store for water? The arm asks, his head swiveling. It's not water, Horseshoe explains patiently. It's water. He says the last half of the word with a harsh, downward intonation, vaguely robotic. He examines a courtesy-sized bottle of water, basic, then shakes the liquid vigorously until a layer of faintly blue froth forms at the top. He hands it over to Patrick. Is he making a joke? Patrick says to Horseshoe, who shrugs. The plastic bottle is warm in his hands as Patrick stares at the thin blue film swirling on the surface. It reminds him of the little rafts of bubbles he would spot riding the calmer, shore-bound waves when he went to the Cape as a child. Detergents from nearby factories, his mother told him. "What's that floating on top?" he asks, handing it over to Horseshoe for inspection. Horseshoe squints through the cheap plastic and immediately looks bored. "That'll go away if you just leave it alone for a while. But what is it?" "I don't know what you call it," Horseshoe says. "It's fine. It'll disappear. My buddy who's in science told me that it happens because water is a little more social than the old stuff. It boils at a slightly higher temperature and freezes at a slightly lower temperature. It forms stronger bonds inside the molecule and with other molecules. So sometimes they clump together. Hence the occasional foam that doesn't really matter and that nobody cares about. I thought water was supposed to be the same thing, though." "Yeah, it's the same," Horseshoe says, distracted. "It's the same as water, just a little bit more so."
Thank you so much. I love how much you capture the labyrinthine Dante's eighth level of hell qualities of IKEA. But it's the Hygge burst that makes me laugh out time every time. This devil's brew you've concocted of Scandinavian culture are built around comfort and relaxation mixed with energy drink marketing for a poisonous water replacement. Do you know that you're being funny? Do you have a sixth sense for it? And is it something that you've practiced and worked through? And do you have someone that you can kind of test things out with?
My partner and I, he's also a writer, and his work is very funny. His name's Alex Gilvary, and his first novel is called From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant. So
I actually teach it.
In Guantanamo. You teach it.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
I teach it in my the Terrorist Imaginary class. But sorry, I interrupted you. It's a great
novel.
Oh,
that's so great. Oh, he's going to love that. We try out material on each other a lot. And I also think that both he and I write about some pretty constricting and pretty depressing material, and you do it alone for the bulk of the time. It's a very solitary effort. So the degree to which you can continue with your project and continue dwelling in that space, in that fictional world, is often determined by how much you can make it bearable for yourself by cracking a joke that breaks the tension and lets a little bit of air into your own writing mood. So I think that I use humor as a way to keep myself moving through the text as I'm writing it. And I also think that, to sell a reader on the idea of, spend 350 pages in a world that's running out of water and is losing its mind is kind of a tall order.
Yeah.
But when there's some humor to draw you through it and keep you in a very sort of affective state, then you can sit with the problem longer, which also has to do, I think, sometimes the climate change discourse can be very oppressive and very hopeless, and to mix more kinds of rhetoric in there, like things that you can do that are practical, personal stories that shift the scale of it from the global to something empathizable, and then venues for what the world could, thinking through what the world could be like in a world that wasn't so blatantly extractive and exploitative. I think like these are all ways of varying the tone so we can continue to be close to the problem and dwell with it.
Yeah, it made me think of the sort of the classical thinking around kind of comedy as the genre that can make change and can have real effects in a text. And I think that's true. And I think you're proving it there while also making us enjoy the ride a little bit more. This is certainly a climate novel, and it's either pre-dystopia or mid-dystopia. But I think of Something New Under the Sun as also a meditation on privacy. Cassidy Carter's life as a child actor trying to be an adult actor is defined in part by the constant surveillance of her public life and the speculation about her private life that happens in online forums. One fan starts a discussion of the possible hidden reasons for Cassidy's, quote, erratic public behavior. Clearly, this is partially a function of celebrity, but are you also weighing in on the fate of everyday people's privacy in an age of social media?
That's such a good question. And I also see how it connects to the course that you're teaching this semester and your own research interests. I think you're exactly right. Like, it is a function of celebrity, but it is also about what we yield up to the world of social media, and mm-hmm. what we gladly yield up and what's taken from us. Seen through the perspective of a character who feels this extractive gaze more often and more deeply than anyone else. Like, I am fascinated when I've spoken to actors about these sorts of psychological weights and experiences that go along with making your face a public resource in a way, like to begin seeing your face posted over the world, recognizing yourself in places where you shouldn't be, according to your own logic of embodiment and knowledge of where you're standing in the physical space. I remember one interview with an actress I did recently who was in a forthcoming movie that's a two-person play, where her face holds the weight of the camera's gaze for these very long shots, including some speech and reaction and emotion. So she talked about how tired she was after these shots because it felt like something had been sapped from her, something had been taken out from her. And I think that even if you do a burst of selfies trying to get the right one, you feel a little bit of that too, the sense that you're a little hollowed out, something's a little missing, you're more exhausted than you should be for having just stood around pressing a button every so often. It's something psychological and spiritual that I think is drawn from you when you scatter your image throughout the world, and when it leaves your control in a way. So I think that looking at Cassidy, she's something of a canary in a coal mine for this. She's experiencing the most of it, but we're all experiencing some of it.
I didn't realize until you said the phrase extractive gaze, how much there is the logic of extraction in both the use of the planet for endless commodifiable resources and the kind of resources that we draw from people either willingly or unwillingly. And thinking about Cassidy running into her nose all the time, people who've had surgery to have a nose just like hers, and seeing it in this incredibly, like, imagine, kind of traumatizing and depersonalizing way, and the extraction logic as working in both ways, which I think is really brilliant.
Yeah, I think, like, one of the things I like about Cassidy too, those, is I personally would feel like, well, I am nobody, I have no nose, everyone is sort of like me, like I'm scattered and decentered. And she sort of will resolutely insist, like, no, that's my nose. That girl's walking around with my nose. Who does she think she is? Even if she is getting a royalty from it and benefiting in that way.
Yeah, that's amazing and so frightening. So I want to ask you a really tangential question, but it's just something that is in my limited pop culture purview. But that is the show What We Do in the Shadows, Taika Waititi's show about vampire roommates. It's I know from your bio that you live in Staten Island, and I was wondering what you thought of this incredibly interesting take on Staten Island with the vampires living there. They have a failed attempt to take control of the city council and to do something about the raccoon problem. It made me really love Staten Island and have a very different vision of it. And I wonder what you think of it.
I mean, it's spot on. I don't know if there are vampires on Staten Island, but there are town hall meetings like that. And there is this funny way in which, like, Staten Island being part of New York City, but not really being part of New York City, being the last borough people remember when they name all the boroughs, and carrying the nickname the Forgotten Borough. It leads into the sort of cultural divergence that has some of the inconveniences of New York City, but also the inefficiencies of any other place put together in one unholy amalgamation. I sometimes think of it as a bad luck borough in a gentle way, because it's the first place where I broke a bone. Sinkholes open up in different places. A sinkhole just opened up on the path I walked to the ferry, and it makes me have to walk a long way around past this herd of geese that are sometimes very aggressive to get there. All this stuff you wouldn't think of as being urban, but which I guess can only happen when things are condensed as they are in a slightly urban space. When we built the courthouse here, they had to halt construction for a while because they found a lot of unmarked dead bodies because it used to be a quarantine area before Ellis Island was open. And in those days, if you died in quarantine, they just buried you somewhere. It was here.
In Staten Island.
In Staten Island. So there is definitely a spurious, inconvenient, obstacle-filled, and sometimes slightly grisly history here, I think.
My only strong memory of Staten Island is from running the New York City Marathon, and you wait for a really long time in Staten Island before you start. And when you start, I luckily, this guy who was running next to me said, make sure you go on the upper section of the bridge. And he didn't say why, but I thought, okay, he seems experienced, I'll go in the upper section. It's because everyone has been waiting so long and they need to pee. And so all these people pee on once they start on over the bridge, but the winds whip the urine into the lower section of the bridge. So if you've had the bad fortune of running in the lower section, then everyone's pee from the marathon ends up on you at the very beginning of your 26 miles. That is my very strong and vivid memory of Staten Island.
Yeah. I mean, that is a hot tip I will remember if I ever have to run the marathon across that bridge.
Yeah, hold it dear to your heart. I wanted to end by asking, if you are a big eco-fiction, climate fiction reader, and if so, what could you recommend for us? And also, I know that you did do reading and research for this project. Would you be willing to recommend some of those source books as well?
Absolutely. And I do read a lot of eco-fiction or climate fiction, but I think that what I read for my own mental health reasons tends to be focused on authors who can stretch away from the dystopian and give me something that feels also invigorating and lifelike in some way. I love Jeff Vandermeer's work because he does such an amazing job animating non-human actors and characters in his work. So the feeling of having a world that is maybe decimated, but is still full of life, is something that helps keep me going. I loved Clade by James Bradley, which is a sort of also post-apocalyptic narrative, but very, very human and very deeply felt. And I find a lot in both work by naturalists or especially indigenous perspectives, like Robin Wall Kimmerer and her Braiding Sweetgrass, where you get to be back in touch with plant life and animal life through these intricate descriptions and explorations of what a cattail can be used for example, and how a cattail's life cycle sort of unfolds, animating the natural world, making you grateful for what we still have and more connected to it, is really an important part of maintaining yourself in an active affective state that you continue to live with the problem, act on the problem, and find ways to source effort to do direct action. For this book, I read a lot of great things. There's a great series of California naturalist guides to specific things like California grasses, California fire, And I found a lot of great details there, but also just to get into the grain of the land, like a lot of things that seem maybe not important enough to extract and foreground in a novel, but which provide this sort of plane against which a really brilliant fact or description or notable form of vegetation stands out, and then you can see like how this would be very important and crucial in your world building. I also read a lot about the bottled water industry and the plastics industry, like Jeffrey Michael's History American Plastic, which is where I found the title to this book. Something New Under the Sun was the marketing slogan that was originally used to market cellophane, the first plastic, which was also naturally derived.
Wow.
Yeah. And then one final thing that I love to recommend to people is this book by Tristan Gooley, who's a natural navigator, I think in Scotland. He's in the UK anyway. And he has this book called The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs that tells you sort of how to navigate a landscape using cues about direction, wind direction, and terrain to find paths through, but also stay on, for example, a true north path. And the attentiveness that he can bring to the way that you see what otherwise would just be a swath of terrain, like that was a big help for me in writing landscape scenes and to thinking about what should stick out and what can exist in the background, because there's always too much to describe.
Mm-hmm. These sound so fascinating, and I love the idea of looking at California natural guides, naturalism guides. I think that's lovely. And braiding sweet grass has been recommended to me by so many people. I feel like now it's an absolute that I have to pick it up.
Yeah, it's such a nourishing book, and it's also a book in a subterranean way, you know, about our dissatisfaction with capitalism, our dissatisfaction with the regimented and profit-driven, extraction-driven modes of life that capitalism implies for us. Mm-hmm. And she grounds it all in like this really deep understanding of nature as both a botanist and as a person with a cultural relationship to indigeneity. I can't recommend that book more.
Well, it's absolutely going on my bedside table. And these are such great recommendations. I really enjoyed our conversation. It was so engaging.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Alexandra.
Thank you, and I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, you too. Well, that's it for this week's episode. My huge thanks to the brilliant and gracious Alexandra Kleeman, whose recommendations will be linked to on our show page at burnedbybooks.com, where you can buy copies of all the books, including Something New Under the Sun, at indie bookstores. Please find all of our past episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, where you can follow the show and suggest it to friends with untreatable book addictions. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.